Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, December 4th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from the University of Albany Department of Biomedical Sciences, offering graduate research opportunities in bacterial infections, antibiotic resistance, and drug discovery. Now accepting PhD and master's applications, albany.edu/BMS. Joining us this afternoon on the Medical Monday is Dr. Harad Hidayat of Vassa Brothers Medical Center. He's here to answer your questions about stroke, brain aneurysms, and other vascular conditions of the brain. Got a headache? We always get a lot of calls on this program, so get yours in early. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Here comes Dr. Hidayat right after the news. Hello again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday, you're not going to believe this one, it's really great, is Dr. Harad Hidayat. He is Director of Cerebrovascular and Endovascular Neurosurgery at Vassa Brothers Medical Center and an Associate Professor at Drexel University School of Medicine. His expertise includes the treatment of aneurysms, stroke, and other vascular conditions of the brain. Dr. Hidayat, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we are delighted to see you here. The number to call, everybody, and this is going to be a very popular show, is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also send us an email at voxpop@wamc.org. Okay, so Dr. Hidayat, how do we know if we have an aneurysm?
Yeah, so unfortunately, most people know about it after it's had a rupture or a bleed. And those can either be pretty severe and debilitating when they rupture, or sometimes they can be relatively small and cause what's classically known as the worst headache of a person's life. And so when they've had a headache that's unlike anything they've ever had before, you sort of investigate to make sure that the first thing that you check for is an aneurysm that's not had a rupture. But oftentimes...
How do they check that?
Yeah, so it starts with as simple as just a CAT scan, which is just a picture of the head is what I tell folks. And oftentimes that'll give us enough information to know what direction to go into next in terms of what kind of what the next picture we're going to need is. And aneurysms are little balloons that grow off of blood vessels. And so what I always tell my patients is that we're going to look at the plumbing. There's something wrong with the plumbing. And so then the next set of studies are going to be something a little bit more advanced to look at the blood vessels themselves and see where the aneurysms are and then sort of go from there to see what to do next. But oftentimes they're actually just found incidentally. Somebody's had a headache, they go to see their doctor orders an MRI of the brain and it turns out they have an aneurysm. It's been there for who knows how long and it's not caused any problems up to now. And oftentimes the headache is, or most often the headache is just not even related to that aneurysm.
And then a stroke, give us a definition.
Yes, so a stroke, what everybody thinks of as a stroke is when the brain actually doesn't get blood flow. One of the blood vessels, plumbing, again, gets blocked up. Blood doesn't get to the brain. And then that part of the brain slowly starts suffering, and then that's where the symptoms come from. And so the things that people think of commonly are problems with getting words out or speaking, weakness on one side of the body, weakness in the arm or the leg on one side, and then just not quite being themselves. And then there's, you know, higher and higher degrees of problems that a stroke will cause. But, you know, the first thing that we think of with a stroke is blood vessels blocked. How can we open it up?
So let me ask you a fast question. We'll take the calls. They're really mounting up. My question to you would be, what's the difference between you and a plumber?
Yeah, I'm a glorified plumber, basically. So the difference between myself and a plumbing plumber.
A lot of education.
Yeah, a lot of
a lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of the technique, a lot higher risk. But actually, what we do is The difference with the plumber is oftentimes a plumber may have to do a lot to open to get to the pipes and change pipes. We can't often change pipes. We have to work with the pipes that we have. And so that's where you have to come up with the kind of sometimes novel new solutions and even come up with new instruments or new techniques or new ways of doing things where you can go and mold the pipe, so to speak, from the inside without having to exchange it.
Fascinating. So you can go up through the groin, I understand, right?
Yep.
And go right to the brain.
Right. That's exactly right. So
it's quite a trip.
Yeah, it is. It's a long distance trip, but you'd be surprised how much we can get done just from that.
How long does it take you with your surgical instrument to get from the groin to the head?
How long? A minute.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, and once you get into the blood vessel in the leg, then to take the small little tiny instruments all the way up literally takes a minute to get into
the
brain.
I love what you say, that it's harder in some cases to be a plumber. My brother-in-law just had a leak from the apartment upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to take down the whole ceiling
and
to get in order to get to the pipes. That's your point. You can't do that.
No.
You could go and you could take somebody's skin away, couldn't you?
And so the training that myself and my partners have is that we trained as neurosurgeons, meaning what everybody thinks of traditionally, if you have a problem in your brain, a brain bleed, we can make an incision, we can remove a piece of the bone, and we can take that blood out, and we can put everything back, close it back up. However, my additional training and my partners as well, and this is all techniques and tools that we've brought to Vassar now, is that we can not only do that procedure to open up from above, but we can go in through the groin, into the brain, through the blood vessels. And oftentimes we do both in one person. I just did that actually 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
Ruptured aneurysm, took care of it through the groin, and then brought it back and took care of it later open.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So there are a lot of calls. Boy, there are a lot of calls. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, make it fast. Go ahead.
Are there specific areas in the skull that are tree-fined to depressurize the brain bleed, or are the fenestrations lesion-dependent?
Yeah, thanks for your call, Jim. So actually, yes, there are, and they are very what you called a trephination. That just means to make a hole in the bone. And a tree fine is actually the older word for what we call a bone flap, or a piece of the bone that removed from the skull. And so the CAT scan that I was talking about earlier, so these procedures are very targeted. And so we get a CAT scan. If we see that there's a bleed in a particular part of the brain on one side, then we can make an opening just over that area to essentially go into the brain and drain that blood and relieve that pressure and likewise the symptoms that bleed is causing in a patient, and then we can put that bone back. And then there are times where the bleed is just so large that the brain needs a little bit more room for swelling, and so we can keep the bone off, put it in storage, let the patient recuperate and recover. Yeah, and then we can bring them back and, you know, let's say 3 months later or so, and
put the bone back.
Yep, exactly.
That's astounding. Okay, thank you, Jim. Let's go to Liz in Warwick, New York. All right, Liz in Warwick, you're on. Go.
Hi, I'm wondering if after a cavernous malformation has been taken out of the midbrain and the brainstem, can it recur? First of all, and second of all, after such a surgery, what is the duration of recovery? I mean, I know first year, second year, but how long realistically can the recovery continue?
Okay, doctor, before you answer that question, I guess we need to know what a cavernous malformation is.
Right. Actually, just a quick question. Is this a procedure that you or somebody you know has had done?
My husband.
Okay. So a cavernous...
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Gotcha. A cavernous malformation is a type of blood vessel abnormality that is found in the brain, other parts of the body as well. But in the brain, it can cause bleeds. And of the things that can bleed in the brain, it tends to be smaller and a more small bleed when it does happen. Where she is saying where this bleed, the midbrain, that's really right in the center of the brainstem. And so all the fibers that are passing from the spinal cord, from the body, and travel up to the brain, the top part of the brain that we all think of, they pass through the midbrain. And so a cavernous malformation in that area, when there's a bleed, that's very high value real estate.
Is it hard to get there?
It's difficult to get to because it's right in the middle of everything.
Right.
And it's literally like the game Operation. When you're going into that area, you're kind of working between nerves and fibers, and it's a very not only tricky area to work with and to get to, but it's also a very sensitive area in that too much manipulation of that area of the brain can cause problems, deficits, weakness, etc. And so the recovery from it really has to do with if there was a bleed initially or if this was found incidentally. And most neurosurgeons would not necessarily operate unless there is a bleed in a cavernous malformation in that part of the brain. And when there's a bleed, many will often wait until there's been a second bleed to really justify the risk of the procedure. And so I presume that's what happened with your husband?
Yes.
Okay.
Hey, Liz, gotta move on. There are 1,000 people behind you. I thank you for your call. Thanks a lot. Yep, bye. Okay.
But the quick answer to her is the recovery can take several years, actually. Several years. Yeah.
All right. It's 2:18 now, 2:19. So what we're going to do is take a very fast. Everybody stay there. Maria, Jerry, Laura, Tom, and Linda, stay where you are, and we'll be right back to you.
Support for WAMC comes from New York Presbyterian Hudson Valley Hospital, offering treatments for heart disease, including care from Columbia doctors, nyp.org/Hudson Valley-cardiac, to find a cardiologist. Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, an inpatient rehabilitation and wellness center, providing healing focusing on the body, mind, and spirit for those with various forms of addictions. VillaVeritas.org for inquiries. New York Oncology Hematology, wishing WAMC listeners a joyous holiday season, NewYorkOncology.com. The Black Sheep Deli, downtown Amherst, a New York-style delicatessen and European-style, all-butterscotch bakery, caterer, and cafe, offering free trade coffee, BlackSheepDeli.com. And from Gazebo, Northampton, Massachusetts, an independent lingerie shop specializing in bra and post-mastectomy fittings, providing support to the Pioneer Valley for almost 40 years. The-Gazebo.com.
And let's go to Maria in her car. Maria, be careful now. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick question with regard to a stroke. My daughter had a stroke when she was 6 years old, and I'm wondering if it's possible for a doctor, a neurologist, to consider her cured because it has not happened again, and she's now 26, looking to get health insurance. And I'm curious as to whether it has to be a pre-existing condition or if because she is no longer medicated or anything else, whether it can be considered she's cured.
Yeah, that's a great question. So was it a bleed or was it a blockage of blood flow?
The stroke was a result of the chicken pox, and she had like a bleed, like a burst and a bleed.
I see. Okay. The tendency with kids is when they've had a vascular issue like that, when they have a bleed, usually there's been some follow-up imaging that's done over the course of time. And, you know, if she's 20 years out, it's often hard to say that they're, quote, cured from it or cleared, as there's always a small risk that some event can happen again in the future. And so if it's a pre-existing condition, I don't know if the insurance company is going to...
Well, that's, the point of the question.
Right. That's a tough one. I don't know the answer to that fully. I'd have to look into it some more.
Yeah, I mean, she's had lots of MRIs since. There's, none of her doctors will come out and say that she's cured. So I'm really concerned, like, does she admit this or, you know, there's never been anything subsequent since the initial problem. And I just sort of at a loss.
Sure. A part of it will also come down to if she's had, repeat recent what we call neurovascular imaging in the form of what's called a CT angiogram or an MR angiogram. These are just ways to get pictures of the pipes without having to put a catheter in someone's body. And if those are all, pretty much looking completely normal, quote, benign, then oftentimes it's probably safe to say that it's cleared, especially if she's, well over 20 years past from the initial
bleed. But I think Maria's point is,
somebody
the insurance
to come and say
company
it.
Asks yeah. you the question and say, have you got pre-existing condition?
Yeah.
What do you say?
You're right. I would be...
I mean, is it a pre-existing condition if you're still being treated for it? I mean, she hasn't been on any meds or any follow-up MRIs or anything for, you know, more than 15 years now.
Right,
I mean,
right. Yeah, you could probably...
At what point,
yeah,
I guess?
You could probably get another set of vascular imaging, and then at that point, if everything looks fine, then sort of go forward from there and say that it's clear.
Remembering, Maria, that we're not lawyers
correct,
here,
yeah.
and you may want some extra help on this.
Yeah.
Someone who's had a stroke to be cured from it, and you know, have you ever said, you know, it was a one-time kind of, you know,
onesie.
I guess that's more my question.
Yeah, you know, it's a little different with kids than it is with adults, because with adults, once they've had an event, it's not related to something. It's usually because of cholesterol, smoking, etc., and so those things are always ongoing. With kids, it's a little bit different.
Right.
Oftentimes, it has to do with their anatomy and they're growing, and they had some infection and it's cleared, and so it is a little bit different. And you can sometimes say that in children. Yes.
Maria, thank you very much. Let's go to we'll go to Laura in Rhinebeck. Laura in Rhinebeck, you're on.
Hi. I have an occasional symptom or phenomenon, something that happens to me physically, and I'm adopted, and it's a little hard to explain, but I came into some contact with my birth mother that I no longer have, but enough to know that she had a massive stroke of some kind. She probably had that in her early to mid-60s. I'm now 55, but for 20 years, I've been having a very infrequent thing that happens where I'll just be at my desk or in a meeting or at home relaxing, not doing anything physically that demanding, and I will all of a sudden feel like my throat is closing and my heart starts going beating extremely fast, and then I start to lose vision. I've never passed out for any length of time from it, but it's very concerning to me. I've talked with various doctors, general practitioners over the years, and because it's so infrequent, I think I've had a couple EKGs, nothing was found, and so I guess we're all kind of collectively shrugging our shoulders. But when I learned that my, birth mother had this massive stroke, I really started to wonder if, there's something that I need, some dots I need to connect.
Yeah, with that. Well, thanks for your call, first of all. With symptoms like that, it's a little bit harder to say. Now, was your mother's stroke, was it a bleed, do you know, or was it, again, a blockage of blood flow?
I'm afraid I don't know, and I'm not going to be able to find out.
So the with the symptoms you're having, it sounds like your doctors went in the right direction and looking towards the heart, because oftentimes those sort of constellation of things go together. In terms of at least protecting you from the risk of a future stroke, knowing that you have a history of a stroke in your family, it's really looking at the regular things that cause strokes in most people. Smoking, high blood pressure, unhealthy diet, having a high cholesterol, not exercising, and modifying those as much as possible, because believe it or not, in changing those risk factors, you can actually lower your risk of a stroke by at least 50%. And sometimes, with medications, if need be, if, for example, the cholesterol is too high, and oftentimes just being on a baby aspirin just to keep the blood a little bit thinned. Mm. And so oftentimes when it's not entirely clear what the history is, just modifying the things we can change and investigate now will reduce your risk significantly, even with your family history. And in terms of your symptoms, I think that may end up being a little bit more of an extensive cardiac investigation. Sometimes abnormal thyroid levels can also cause these sort of palpitation kind of feelings and a sudden rush where you sort of feel this beating in your chest and then your throat tightens up as well.
Could any of that be emotional?
So, sure, it can. But she was saying it happens when she's just kind of hanging around, not doing anything.
Right,
so
that's right. Well, thank you so much for the call, Laura. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Okay, and now we're going to go to Jerry in Fonda. All right, Jerry in Fonda, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Doctor, If you yourself had a 5-millimeter basilar tip aneurysm that was found 8 or 9 years ago and hasn't grown at all in size, would you yourself opt to have a stent put in, or would you opt to monitor it with an annual CTA scan or an MRA?
I bet I know what he's going to ask you. How old are you?
I am 66.
Okay, and it's been 8 years, you said, that it's not grown in size?
Yes, it was found 8 years ago, and it has not grown at all. It's 5 millimeters.
Okay, and are you a smoker?
No.
Any family history of anybody who's had aneurysm ruptures or brain bleeds?
No.
None. Okay. And then really the last thing is, has the appearance of the, not so much the size, but the way it looks changed at all?
No, my neurosurgeon says it's stable.
Yeah. So,
you know, it appears to be stable and there's, very little change.
Right. So of that size, usually once it gets to about 7 millimeters or so is when we really start thinking that the risk of doing a treatment outweighs the risk of, not doing a treatment, or I should say the risk of a rupture associated with an aneurysm, particularly with basilar tip aneurysms. And, the treatment for these used to be open surgery. Sometimes you still need to do that, meaning you take the bone off, get to that blood vessel and put a clip on it. And it's a very complicated procedure, much like where the prior caller had called where the location of her husband's bleed was. And so now these procedures with putting in coils and stents, which we do, like we were talking about earlier, with access through the groin, they're very great ways of taking care of this problem that used to be a big, big issue. But of that size that yours has been, and it's been stable for this long a period of time, it's probably not unreasonable to continue watching it.
Okay. Thank you, doctor.
Sure.
Thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Now we got two people waiting. So if you want to get on, watch this, Doc. Whoosh. If you want to get on, now's a good time to call. Again, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to, let's see here. Yeah. Tom in on the Mass Pike near Worcester.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My question's related to my wife. Has been diagnosed with trigeminal neuralgia, and 14 months ago she had vascular decompression surgery, and the symptoms of the trigeminal actually dissipated very well for the first 4 to 6 months, and of course the back of her head was very numb, and that was expected because her nerves were waking up, as the neurosurgeon explained. But now, after 14 months, she's beginning to feel a little bit of pressure on the front, not as bad as it was, and that was also a potential. But the back of her head is really bothering her with regard to, she says she feels like the skin on her scalp is shrinking, and she gets numerous dull, repeating pain. And I wanted to hear what you might have to say about that.
Yeah, thanks for your call. So this is kind of the same thing as what your neurosurgeon had told you with respect to the incision initially, that area being numb. As nerves grow back, so-called regeneration, they start making new connections with each other, sprouting new nerve endings, etc. And sometimes as that happens, it can cause, stimulate, make you feel like it's got some weird feelings and sensations going on. And so oftentimes after the numbness phase has gone away from an incision that's being made and these nerves start growing back, people can feel the whole gamut of things from pressure to itching to tingling to burning, the whole thing. And usually just as you give it time, it tends to get better because those nerves will eventually mature and those feelings will improve. But sometimes when they're lingering, there's oftentimes, and it becomes debilitating, there's things that can be done such as nerve blocks and such to the area that can help kind of numb it up for prolonged periods of time that help some folks. But that's pretty rare, honestly.
Yeah, he had mentioned potentially applying such a block through a needle.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Tom, I'm going to let you go. Thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Linda in Dalton. All right, Linda in Dalton, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thank you for taking my call. In 2013, I was diagnosed with a double aneurysm that was internal carotid artery. One was 6 millimeters, one was 5 millimeters. And they were addressed using a femoral artery catheter, and coils and a stent were installed. So my question is, what is the risk that I might develop more aneurysms in the future, and how effective are the coils and the stent long term?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. So the coils and stents are excellent in terms of their durability. The one thing with them is that as they settle into place, they can tend to get a little bit smaller, so to speak, is probably the easiest way of putting it. And so what happens is when the balloon was of a, let's say, 5 millimeter size, as you said one of your aneurysms was, over mm-hmm. the course of a year, these coils can settle and they can maybe only take up 3 millimeters of space. And so when you do an angiogram, meaning a dye study to look at the blood vessel, you can actually see the aneurysm filling with some blood again. And the danger with an aneurysm, and the reason that you had your treatments, was that if an aneurysm can get blood into it, then it can rupture. And so we don't want to have that happen. And so we put these coils in there to cause blood to clot. And then as it clots off, then blood can't go into the aneurysm anymore. And so now it's taken care of. Mm-hmm. And the fancy phrase we use is it is excluded from the circulation.
Right.
And so what can happen over the course of time is as these coils shrink up, then you can have filling of the aneurysm, and then the aneurysm can start growing again, which is when we do a surgery, meaning opening up and putting a clip on the aneurysm, that does not happen. However, when you put coils in, this can happen over time, which is why we routinely continue surveillance of patients. And so I can tell you that myself, my partners, the way that we do it at Vassar is that if we put a clip on somebody's aneurysm with a open surgical procedure, we tend to not get any more imaging done of their brain except for another 5 years later. And exactly the reason for that is to look for new aneurysms, because those can occur in patients who've had
aneurysms. And what is the risk of repeated aneurysms?
So it's the same as with having an aneurysm from the get-go, is the risk of bleed that comes with an aneurysm, and that's sort of calculated based on their size, their location, and the patient's age.
No, I guess the question that I was asking is there more of a risk of developing aneurysms? Do you see that in your patients after you have seen them and they have had it one or, in my case, two aneurysms?
Yes, they do have a tendency to have a higher recurrence rate, but new aneurysms coming up. And in your case, I would imagine that's after you've had the coiling done on these aneurysms, you've had follow-up imaging. And so usually...
Oh, yes, yeah. And I'm about to have
there
my annual.
Yep.
Linda, we have to let you go. Thank you very much for your call.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
1-800-348-2551. We've got a lot of people waiting now, as it happens. Doctor, I have a question for you that we lay people would like to ask you. One, what is a millimeter? How long is that?
A millimeter?
Well, no, was that what you mentioned?
Yeah, the sizes that we go off of are literally the same millimeters you get in school on a
centimeter. So what would that look like in terms of your the top part of your index finger?
Oh, a skin crease.
A millimeter. Okay.
And the scary thing with aneurysms, brain-related things, is that oftentimes a 2 millimeter blister is what we call it on a blood vessel. It can have a terrible effect when it bleeds, when there's a tear of something that small.
Okay, I'll ask you another question later, because mm-hmm. we've got so many people waiting on the phone here. Let's go to John in Chatham. Okay, John, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had an aortic valve replacement in my 20s. I'm now in my 40s. And I was wondering what the long-term effect is of warfarin on my valvular health.
Okay, so warfarin Warfarin is a blood thinner.
Right, yeah,
go
exactly.
Ahead. Yeah.
And I'm sorry, you said the long-term effect on your what?
On my vascular health, am I in a higher risk of stroke or aneurysm later on?
Actually, you are at a lower risk because you're, in terms of having a blockage happen because of, if a blockage is there and then a clot forms in that space, that's how a stroke happens or a heart attack happens. That's what they are by definition. And so your risk is actually is lower, particularly if you're, ideally, if you're Coumadin is at the, or warfarin is at the level that it's supposed to be. And so long-term risk with that is lower, but heaven forbid, if you have a bleed, the bleed would be larger because your blood's not clotting normally.
Mm-hmm. But you did say have an 81 milligram aspirin.
Yeah. And most people who are not necessarily on Coumadin, or excuse me, warfarin.
Right. Yeah. Okay, thanks, John. All right, now we're going to go to Wendy in Delmar. Okay, Wendy, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thank you for taking my call. My question concerns my husband and whether or not he is at greater risk for an aneurysm. He's got a history of blood bleeds in his family. His paternal grandfather, we believe, we know he died of a stroke. We think it was a bleed. We're not sure. His mother had a stroke, and his sister had a stroke when she was 59, and she passed away from it. So we're wondering, is my husband at a greater risk for an aneurysm? If he is, what kind of steps should we take? Does he need a CAT scan? Whatever.
Yeah, were these strokes that they had, were they bleeds?
We believe they were. We're not sure on the grandfather because that was a long time ago, but on the mother and the sister, yes.
And were they thought to be related to aneurysms, or they kind of, everybody just said they're bleeds?
I guess I'm kind of conflating aneurysm with bleed, I guess.
Okay. Well, one of the simplest things to do and most common reason for a bleed in the brain is actually having years and years of high blood pressure. And so controlling blood pressure levels is really a quick, I shouldn't say quick, but it's a very easy way to lower that risk of having a bleed in the brain. The next thing is, if you have enough of a concern for aneurysms in the family, what we do in my group and at Vassar Brothers is that when we have a patient with a, let's say, a ruptured aneurysm or an aneurysm that we've found and has not ruptured and we're going to take care of so that they don't have a rupture in the future, we provide letters to their family so that their children or their siblings, meaning first degree relatives, can get what's called a screening study. And an MRA is usually what we'll have done, but a CTA is another study. And a CTA is a CAT scan, which is a fancy X-ray you have done, and they inject dye at the same time, which can show the blood vessels, and you can find an aneurysm that way. An MRA is, it doesn't give you any radiation. It's an MRI that looks at the blood vessels, and it doesn't give you any dye either. And you can see these aneurysms on these studies, and these are what's called non-invasive ways to do screening for aneurysms.
Wendy, I'm so sorry we have to take a little breaklet here, but thank you for your wonderful call. Appreciate it. Okay, so now we have two people on the phone, Leah and Bonnie, and we have a third of the show to go. So if you want to get on, now's the time to do it. 1-800-348-2551. Take it away, Professor.
Support for WAMC comes from Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany. Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar. Dinner entrees served with soup salad and shrimp appetizers. Delivery to Greater Albany, including Gilderland, 518-432-0358. Dr. Richard Holub with the Neurological Associates of Albany. Conducting Alzheimer's research for over 25 years, currently conducting a research study for those with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. 518-426-0575 for information. Nathan Litauer Hospital, Gloversville, New York. Announcing new primary care center on Main Street Fonda, now open, nlh.org. Bergeron Electrical Services, for over 30 years, providing the Pioneer Valley and Western Massachusetts with all electrical services, interior and exterior lighting, generator installation, and more, bergeronelectrical.net. And from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting the Art of New York annual juried art show through January 3rd. celebrating New York's regional artists. ArkellMuseum.org for details.
We're back with Dr. Herad Haddad. He's a wonderful physician, and as you know, he knows how to speak your language, and that's what I love about having him on the show, because, you know, it's all very easy to understand. So let's go here to Leah in Saratoga. You're on, Leah.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate it. Back in 2000, I started having facial sensations of things on my face. And then in 2006, I had a sudden onset of a pulsatile tinnitus. And then finally, it ended up with this facial sharp burning and tingling in like the lower branch of my trigeminal nerve around my mouth and chin. And then afterward, I kept going to doctors and they found a dural fistula. And so in 2008, they did some coils and a stent for this dural fistula. So now I'm coming up on 10 years on this thing, and I still live with this chronic atypical facial pain, which I don't think there's anything I can do about. I also had a hemangioma in that lip. So I guess my first question is should that stent, like, you know, should I go back for any follow-up exams? It's coming up on 10 years. Kind of like what's the lifetime of a stent?
Okay, great question. Let's go, Doc.
Yeah, that is a really good question. Actually, it goes back to the a lot of these technologies are very new. And so we are just coming on the age now of people who've had procedures like yours done who have now had a stent in for 10 years. This is new terrain, really. And so what a lot of myself, my colleagues, my partners do is we follow people with non-invasive imaging, meaning not having to go in through the groin into the blood vessel to do what's called an angiogram, which is the most accurate study of a blood vessel, pipe study, basically. And so I would imagine that MRAs or CTAs, any of those procedures you had done for a while as follow-up?
Well, I did one more angiogram like the year after the stent was put in, but that was done down in New York City. And since then, they continue to look for things because like the facial neuropathies have gone from the third branch to the first branch. So they've continued to do MRIs.
Yeah.
But actually, since 2009, I haven't done a CTA or an MRA or an angiogram, and I just kind of wonder, you know, is this thing ever going to break down, you know?
Yeah.
Or you?
Great question. So it's in that realm of time now, it's probably worth relooking because these can recur or they can sprout up in different parts there near to where you had the prior treatment.
Okay, thank you, Leah. 1-800-348-2551. We got Andrea, Kathy, Robert, and Bonnie all waiting to talk to you, Doc. So let's go now to the longest waiting of them all, which is Bonnie in North Adams. Hey, Bonnie in North Adams, you're on.
Okay, thanks for taking my call. Sure. I just had a comment to the woman who said she was adopted and had found out her birth mother had had a stroke. While she was describing her symptoms, I had all those very same symptoms 15 or 16 years ago. When I was in resting, not doing anything hard, my heart would suddenly begin to pound, and I could feel it in my throat, and my vision would go from the outside in, and I'd feel like I was going to pass out. Turns out I have an irregular heartbeat, and I've been taking a beta blocker once a day for all that time and have had no further issues.
Which is exactly what Dr. Haddad suspected was the case.
Yes. Yeah. And I thought it might just put her at ease if she were still listening.
That's great. Very helpful.
Okay. Thank you very, very much for that. All right. And now we go to Andrea in Kingston. Is it Andrea or Andrea? Always
Andrea.
Puzzled me. Andrea. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I think in 2009, I thought I had sort of like stroke symptoms. And what happened is that they did an MRI and then they found out that the blood veins coming from the brain were spider-like and that there was a blood clot in there. And I've been on the mini aspirin and Plavix ever since then, and I'm wondering whether this is ever going to disappear or what is going to happen there?
Yeah, so I'm not entirely sure what this was. Was it a sinus thrombus? Is that
It says left posterior frontal development venous anomaly, venous
I see. Gotcha.
Angioma.
Yes, okay. So when we are, our brains are developing, blood gets to the brain in the arteries. Those are certain types of pipes. And then blood gets out of it from the veins. And usually they have a pretty well-organized system of reaching each other and making those connections. And sometimes in some areas, one vein can tend to take over a larger area to drain than other veins will. And so a developmental venous anomaly, which is what you have, is just a larger vein in one spot and a spider-like vein, like you say. And so that's something that's probably been there your whole life, actually. And people do tend to put folks on a little bit of a blood thinner, but it's been there your whole life and it will remain there. And it usually doesn't cause any problems and is usually just an incidental finding, actually.
Thank you, Andrea. Okay, let's go to Let's go to Robert in Schenectady. Robert, you're on.
How you doing, doctor? Thanks for taking my call. I got just a quick question about cholesterol numbers here. I just went and had a primary, see my primary physician, and she told me my numbers was like 215, and she tried to put me on a statin here. My question is, do I need to be on a statin, or maybe if I just worked out a little more with that kind of,
Yeah, so the
numbers go down.
Sure. So if it's the LDL that you're talking about, which is what everybody would call the bad cholesterol,
LDL, the bad.
Yeah, 215 is quite high. And to give you an idea, the target everybody is shooting for is less than 100. And so when it's in that range, being on a statin is the right way to go, but then exercising helps it that much more. And then likewise, exercising will also help all the other problems that can come with it too. So I would go ahead and go with both. It won't hurt.
Thank you, Robert. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're down to two people. We've got about 6 or 7 minutes more. We can get a couple of you in. Let's go to Kathy in Saugerties. Kathy in Saugerties, you're on. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, are you there?
Yep, we're here. Are you there?
I thank you for taking my call. My sister has told me, her daughter, my niece, who's 54, she will turn 55 in a couple weeks. This past Tuesday morning, she woke up feeling very dizzy, and she went to work anyway. She loves her job, and she felt even worse there at work. So she was taken to the Strong Memorial Hospital. She lives near Rochester, and they did a whole battery of tests. They decided that she'd had a mild stroke, but they couldn't find any, everything came back normal. But the doctor did, one of the doctors did suspect a thyroid low problem. My question is, how is thyroid related to a stroke, or how could it be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the thyroid levels, the function of the thyroid, tends to be sort of an overarching thing, a master hormone, if you will, to a degree. And so really for many things in the body to function just normally, they actually need the thyroid to be functioning normally. And then once the thyroid stops functioning the way that it's supposed to, whether it's too active or overactive, that can cause, as if you've known anybody with thyroid problems, it can cause a whole gamut of symptoms. And so really the thyroid touches on many of the systems in the body to cause symptoms. Likewise, it'll do the same in increasing somebody's stroke risk. I don't know if your niece's thyroid is too active or underactive. But nonetheless, one of the things we always check when a patient comes in with a stroke or stroke-like symptoms, besides their cholesterol and their blood pressure, and if they smoke, is thyroid, to make sure that that level is addressed appropriately. Because in order for the body to optimally function, you have to have a thyroid that's working well.
And you
I see.
You could do medication
of course, she's not a smoker. And she jogs, and she has an exercise equipment in her home, mm-hmm. and she's slim and always been in taking care of herself that way as far as exercise. So this is what the big mystery is.
Yeah.
So the thyroid then controls just about everything in our body.
It has an
it has an
involvement in it, not necessarily a control, but certainly if the thyroid's not working well, it will affect many of the systems, and then it'll have downstream problems.
Doc, which is worse, an overactive thyroid or an underactive thyroid?
Neither of them is good, but the one that you tend to see more problems with from a stroke related standpoint, underactive thyroid.
I see. Interesting.
Thank you very much for the information.
Sure.
And once you take that thyroid medication, you have to take it for the rest of your life?
Usually, yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yep. But okay. It's an easy fix. It works great.
Okay, that's right. Okay, let's go to Radu. But before we do, I want to say Radu, who's waiting on the phone patiently, is the last call we have. And we have time for more. So if you want to get on, now's the time to do it. 1-800-348-2551. Radu, you're on.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is, I have an 8.5-year-old daughter. We flew back from Florida last Tuesday. She complained. I mean, everyone had the ears plugged on one eye. Everything was okay on Wednesday. On Thursday night, she developed the symptom of, she said that she cannot read and the room spins around with her. So I said, okay, we'll wait a little bit. Then on Saturday morning, I had her evaluated by the pediatrician. On Sunday morning, she was slightly better, she told me. But then we went for a walk up the hill, towards the Berkshires. And today in the morning, she told me she's worse. So I was wondering if, the altitude could prone someone to a neurovascular event, either a stroke or an aneurysm or either one. And if the symptoms are compatible, she walks straight, but she says that the room is spinning with her.
Yeah, that's a good question. So the common things tend to be common is one of the expressions we like to use. And so, if your daughter's been having problems with her ear feeling full and then the room spinning, so the balance, one of the balance sensors of the body is in the middle ear there. And so if she's having what sounds like vertigo type symptoms, then the more likely finding is that it's an inner ear problem or a middle ear problem rather than a stroke, particularly since in kids, strokes are relatively rare. That's not to say that they don't happen, but they won't often present with room spinning or dizziness. They'll have other things that go with them too, not just this. And altitude, as you pointed out, can have an effect too.
Most likely the neuro symptoms are due to the inner ear, but not to the brain.
Probably, yeah. More than likely, okay. But that's not to say that it couldn't be.
Yeah, thank you, Radu. All right. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. Whoa, there goes Lisa. I don't know what became of her. She seems to have left us. Let's go to Maria in Cambridge. All right, Maria, your turn. Hi, Maria.
Hi.
Your turn. Go ahead.
Hi.
You're on.
Listen. No, I'm here. Hi. I have I had chronic headaches for a month, every day, and the doctor ordered an MRI. And I also had sudden onset of high blood pressure. And my question is the MRI was a non-contrast MRI. Is that okay? Is that telling us enough that we need to know? It was just my GP that ordered this.
Yeah, so it can. What contrast does, contrast is just the dye that's added to these studies. That can just give you a little bit more information. Sometimes if people have tumors, if they have abnormal blood vessels, if they have things growing where they're not supposed to be growing, contrast can help show that. Oftentimes, if something's growing where it's not supposed to be, when you have a non-contrasted MRI, meaning an MRI without dye, then you tend to have to, the report comes back, and then you tend to have to go back to have another one done with contrast, which is where sometimes the tendency will come to do it with and without contrast at once.
All right, thank you.
Or to start with, excuse me.
Let's go now to... Okay, so... Let's go now to Brad in Saugerties. All right, Brad, you got to make it quick because we're almost done. Go ahead.
Hi.
It's got to be real quick.
Yep. My father died of a brain aneurysm when he was 46. I'm now 60. Is there any hereditary risk with brain aneurysm?
Yes, there is a small risk. particularly to firstborn or first-degree relatives. And so getting screened is something you can have done with what's called non-invasive imaging in the form of an MRA or a CTA, which are just pictures of the brain that don't end up having any invasiveness to them. There's no risk to them. And usually primary care physicians can get that set up in people who have a history of an aneurysm in their family.
Okay, does that require a dye? Like to put a dye in, or is it just...
No, the CTA does, but the MRA does not.
Okay. MRA.
Yeah, those are a little bit
trickier. We are out of time. Thank you very much. Our apologies to Bob in Clifton Park, Dan in Johnstown, and anybody else who got left on the time on the phone. I want to thank Dr. Hirad Hadaya of Vassar Brothers Medical Center for being with us today. Support for the Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute, the new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our wonderful engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producers, Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartrock. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.